Mr. Sally, Reel 3.
I just said that the sanity of Captain Surtees was in question, in that he was wanting to send crews off in conditions which were absolutely impossible. Not only the swordfish crews, but at times the wild crews he wanted to send off at night. Val Jones, the skipper, the CO of the squadron, was not alone in his concern. While at Kola Inlet, that's Bianga Bay, he was invited to a discussion with the ship's executive officer, Commander Cartwright, RN, and the senior medical officer, Lieutenant Commander Waterman, who was seriously worried about the health of the air crews. Both were beginning to have serious reservations about the captain's sanity, but while Commander Cartwright was apparently prepared and ready to take over the ship, the senior medical officer could not bring himself to make the final and difficult step of certifying Captain Surtees as insane. Val Jones, the CO of the squadron, who was tired out and exhausted, left them to it, and nothing was done. Whilst we were on this convoy to Russia, we were frequently attacked by JU-88s from Norwegian airfields. There always seemed to be some pre-warning of these attacks from the Admiralty, and we often had signals from the Admiralty saying, "Be prepared to be attacked by aircraft at dawn tomorrow." And lo and behold, at dawn tomorrow, we were attacked. At the time, we had no idea how they got this information, but one supposes that all this was gathered up by the ultra-secret code-breaking device. During one of these attacks, Al Burgum, the senior pilot in the fighter section, took off with his number 2, Dusty Miller, in very, very bad conditions. And there was no purpose achieved whatsoever, because once they were up in the air, it was dark and they couldn't see anything, and they did not get any contact with the enemy aircraft. But Al and his number 2 became separated, and whilst Al eventually got back on board, in a very shaken condition, I might add, poor Dusty Miller was last seen with his wheels down, with his navigation lights on, waggling his wings, coming down between the lines of the convoy towards the carrier, with all the ships everywhere shooting hell at him. And eventually HMS Bologna shot him down. It was never acknowledged that they had shot down one of our aircraft, but it was clearly seen by some of the fighter pilots on the deck. Bologna claimed to have shot down a JU-88, when in fact they had shot down a Wildcat of 835 Squadron. Another incident occurred, which is of interest. Sub-Lieutenant Eames and Brown had been on a long convoy, a long anti-submarine patrol, and came back indicating that they were very, very low on petrol. The aircraft replaced their patrol, because obviously one tried to get an aircraft off the deck before one landed the other aircraft on, so there was some continuity. Had some difficulty, and instead of striking that aircraft down into Eames and Brown land on, they tried to rectify the batter on the deck, and the captain insisted that the aircraft on deck was to be off before they landed on the second aircraft with Eames and Brown on it. Well, eventually Eames and Brown came down in the sea because they ran out of petrol. And because of their immersion suits, they were picked up by HMS Cassandra, cruiser, I think. But this wasn't the end of the story. because HMS Cassandra later on was torpedoed and broke in half. Luckily, Eames and Brown were in the right half and they survived, but Cassandra had to be towed astern back to Kola Inlet. But here again is an example of obstinacy being the result of a loss of an aircraft, and quite possibly it could have been the loss of the crew as well. My overwhelming memory of Russian convoys is the desperate tiredness and tension of flying. Tension of standing by, because even if one wasn't flying, one was more often than not in the ready room, all kitted up, standing by to go off at a moment's notice. And the difficulty of sleeping in the very, very short periods of rest we were given between either standbys or operational flights. And the difficulty in sleeping was caused by the movement of the ship, which, as I've said, at sometimes was 54 degrees. During the attack on the convoy, four torpedoes had been aimed at Narana, all of which she evaded, and one radio-controlled glider bomb, which fell harmlessly astern. Another occasion on which Val Jones, the CO, had to stand up for his air crew occurred when Surtees, the captain, ordered the launch of two Wildcats in completely unsuitable conditions. And Val Jones said, right, you can have your two Wildcats launched, provided you enter in the ship's log that you are launching them against my advice as squadron commander. And luckily, Surtees backed down on this. I had another experience of this when we were not on the convoy. We were going up the west coast of Scotland from Greenock up to Scarpa. And I was squadron duty officer for the day, which meant that I spent my day in the hangar organising the striking down of aircraft, organising putting the aircraft in the lift and onto the deck, and generally organising the maintenance and things in the deck. One took this duty on once every 12, 13 days, which, when you were duty officer in the hangar below decks, you were responsible for what went on. And the phone message came down from the bridge, range to aircraft. That's the word I was fumbling for just now, ranging aircraft. Range to aircraft, which meant unlashing them from the deck, pushing them onto the lift, taking the lift up and ranging them on the deck and lashing them down on the deck. The ship at this time was rolling quite considerably, and there was a fair amount of oil and grease on the deck. Nobody's fault in those conditions when ships are rolling as much as that oil and stuff does get on the deck. So I called back to the bridge and said, is this an operational requirement? And they said, no, it's a training exercise. And I said, well, I am not going to unlash the aircraft, because A, you will write off two or three aircraft immediately and possibly kill somebody, some of the troops who are trying to push it into the lift. And, you know, the answer came back, that's an order. So I said, I would like that order in writing, please, before I carry it out. This is always the last resort. You see that if you come before a court-martial, if you haven't got it in writing, you're done for. So I said, I want it in writing. I was immediately relieved of my squadron duty officer for the day, sent to my cabin. And the next chap on the list took over, unlashed the aircraft, and what I had foretold happened. It slithered off over the deck, and it wrote off three aircraft slithering around in the oil. Nobody was killed, luckily. But, I suppose, I heard nothing more about it. I wasn't charged with disobeying an order, and I suppose they thought there wasn't much they could do about it. I think that gives you a pretty good picture of Russian convoys. There was only one other trip we did, and that was an attack on shipping off the Norwegian coast. The Germans were ferrying iron ore down the coasts of Norway, and we were trying to stop it. And we went off in Nirana over towards Norway with an escort group of sorts. I've forgotten what we had with us then. And the idea was for us to rocket attack these merchant ships at night. Well, this was January 1945. And by this time, incidentally, I'd been in the squadron for 2 years and 9 months, which I think is a bit of a record for an operational squadron. And I had asked to be relieved, which wasn't unreasonable. All my contemporaries had been relieved time and time again before me. And I remember Val Jones coming to me and saying, look, we've got one more trip to go over and have a go at these ships with rockets. How about it? So I said, all right, put me down for it. So I stayed on. But again, it was absolutely impossible weather. It was blowing a snowstorm when we took off. And I remember we took off and two other aircraft took off and started formating on me because I was leading with the CO as my observer. And I said to Val, I said, no, I don't think we can go on. We're losing airspeed now. I said, I'm sure we're freezing up. We're icing up. So he did a very lamp signal to the ship, interrogative go, and the answer came back no. And we went back, landed on, and that was the end of that. So we didn't do that shipping strike. I left the squadron then, but they did the shipping strike another 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, I think, with the replacement crews. Now, after I came off operational duty, after 2 years, 10 months with 835 Squadron, I was sent on indefinite sick leave. I remember going to HMS Daedalus at Leon Solent for a central medical board medical. And the chap there wanted to put me off flying altogether. I said, oh no, I'm not going off flying. I said, you put me on flying, but not night flying. I'll be happy. So I managed to persuade him not to put me off flying, whereas all the rest of the chaps who were put ashore at the same time as me were stopped flying for about 6 months. And I was sent home on indefinite leave. I wasn't so daft at this time to send a telegram to the Admiralty waiting instructions. I had about 3 months at home. And then I was stationed, sent to Royal Naval Air Station at Henstridge, which is just over the border from here in Somerset. And I was CO station flight, 3 or 4 stints in Reliance, and a couple of Seafires, a couple of Spitfires, ferrying spares and bodies around the country. Very, very nice little job. Beer and Skittles in the evening, flying around the country during the day, if I wanted to. I had 4 or 5 sub-lieutenants there, and if I didn't feel like flying, I sent them off. And if it was a trip I liked and the weather was nice, I went. Delightful. And then I was demobbed from Henstridge and came home, went back to the education department.
So the sick leave was because of the stress of night flying in particular?
Oh, yes. Nervous exhaustion. And as I say, all of us were put in front of a medical board, and all except me, I think, were struck off flying. I insisted on staying on.
Were any of the others from your own squadron?
All of them. Yes, there were 6 or 7 of us put ashore at that time. Val Jones was called up to the Admiralty to explain why, in Captain Surtees' report on him, which captains do on squadron COs, the captain had assessed him as 2 out of 10. And Val went before this board in the Admiralty and explained what had gone on and said, I would like to be court-martialed so that the facts can come out. And Val told me afterwards that some dear old jovial paternal avuncular Captain R.N. took him to lunch, plied him with drink, and said, look, he said, don't take this any further. I'll guarantee that you keep your half ring. He was lieutenant commander. He said, I'll guarantee that you keep your lieutenant commander, and we'll see you get a CO's job when you've had your sick leave. And Val, I suppose, was so fed up with things that he said, all right, I'll accept that. So he didn't have his court-martial. Surtees got a bar to his DSO.
What do you think about all this business nowadays that we hear about the need of people in wars for counselling?
Well, I mustn't be unkind, but I feel that we didn't have it in World War II, not that I'm aware of.
Would it have done any good?
I don't know.
Do you have any VE Day memory or VJ Day memory?
Yes. I remember on VE Day I was at Royal Naval Air Station, Henstridge. And I remember that we all clambered upon an old Austin A-10, which was a square box one wheel. We had about 12 of us in it. And we all made for Bournemouth, which was down on the coast, calling on every pub on the way. And I remember on the way a policeman stopping us, and he could see that we were all pretty well tanked up. He said, take it easy, boy, take it easy. He said, I have a dreadful accident down the road. Horses been killed. Take it easy. And, you know, he wasn't going to run us in, but off we went and didn't take the slightest bit of notice of the poor old boy. And every pub we went into, you know, the drinks were free. VJ night was a different matter because we were living in Nissen huts at Henstridge, and each Nissen hut had a tannoy system in it, which at 7 o'clock in the morning, do you hear there, you know, get up or whatever it was, wakey, etc. So we tore the leads out of it, so we didn't get all this damn nonsense. We didn't get woken up in the morning. But conversely, of course, when at whatever time it was in the middle of the night, it was declared that VJ Day had, you know, that the bomb had been dropped. This was put out over the tannoy saying the bomb had been dropped and the war was over. We were all asleep and didn't hear a damn thing about it. Mind you, we made up for it next day. Whilst poor old Val Jones had a rotten report, I must say that much as I disliked Surtees, he did give me a good report at the end of the day. In fact, he said he was an excellent officer, first-class pilot, and had done a good job with 835, or words to that effect. Can I just tell you one other aspect of Surtees' character? He's dead now, so he won't be able to sue me for libel, I hope. I was one of the selected few who was called upon to partner him at bridge when we were in harbour, or to play bridge with him. He'd make up a four. Now, it was very noticeable that if I happened to be Surtees' partner in this bridge match, he was very abstemious when he was pouring out my drinks. If I was playing against him, he lorruped it into the glasses. And he, you know, it became noticeable after a time that he was obviously trying to get the opponents a little bit reckless in their bidding so that he could win.
Any Baedeker raid memories from Exeter?
Well, I wasn't home at the time of the Baedeker raids, and obviously I was rather worried as to what had happened to my family when it happened. But I do remember coming home a few days after they had occurred, perhaps it was a week or so, and I lived in a little village called Alphington, which is a suburb to the south of Exeter now, and I got on the bus to come into Exeter to see who I could meet, my old school pals to have a few drinks with. I remember getting on the bus, and when the bus got into the town, I had no idea where I was. I couldn't pinpoint myself, and I just did not know where to get out of the bus to get to where I wanted to go. The place had just been razed to the ground, and impossible, as it was at that time, to in any way orientate oneself as to exactly where one was in the city. A most weird and not terrifying, but a very weird experience.